Welcome to Face to Face. Face to Face is an in-depth look at the life and career of a popular sports figure from a Christian perspective. Now, here's your host of Face to Face, Tom Rust.
Well, thank you very much, and welcome to our Face to Face podcast. We're glad that you're able to join us today. A few weeks ago, I had the chance to meet with a legend in racing. I had the chance to go to a book signing, and the book was called A Checkered Past, and it is the story of Al Unser Jr. as told to Jade Gers. Now, most people would think about Al Unser Jr. as being an Indy driver from an outstanding family. The Unser family, Al Sr., Al Jr., and Bobby Unser have won the Indianapolis 500 9 times. Al Sr. won it 4 times. Bobby Unser won it 3 times, and Al Jr. won it twice. But this story is the graphic story about Al Jr. And even though his gifts as a driver and his easy affability were the public persona, behind the scenes there was, as the book describes, an appetite for drugs and alcohol that destroyed his private life. And so as you read the book in graphic detail, you'll understand all the things that he went to, which led to a number of divorces, financial ruin, and a number of things, even a suicide attempt. But one of the things that happened to Al that is so important was that he found Jesus Christ as his personal Savior. So I think you'll enjoy this time that we had with Al Unser. Recently, we met with him on the northwest side of Indianapolis. And I think you'll enjoy the story and hearing, in his own words, the story of Al Unser. All right, welcome to Face to Face. Our guest today is Al Unser Jr., the winner of 2 Indianapolis 500s, part of the legendary Unser family, and the family is winners of 9 Indy 500s. Dad, Al Sr., won 4 times. Uncle Bobby Unser won 3. Al, great to have you. How'd you get started in racing?
Well, I was basically born into it. My dad started me racing go-karts when I was 9 years old. And it just went from there.
Yeah, you got started back then, and your dad, of course, was very successful. Your dad won the first of his 4 500s in 1970, repeated in 1971. Seeing that, did you believe that someday you could win the Indianapolis 500 someday?
Well, I was 8 years old at the time that that dad won his first one, and it being the Johnny Lightning special. Johnny Lightning was like a Hot Wheels car set, and so it was a toy for kids my age at the time, and so just seeing him at the time, it wasn't televised on TV. What it was televised was closed circuit TV, and so in Albuquerque there. We went to the Civic Auditorium, and just a big screen on the 500, and Dad won, and it was just a very special day, and that's when I truly fell in love with the Indy 500. Was that day in 1970, and so, you know, just being born where I was and having Dad as my father and so on, it was just a natural progression for me, and so right at that time they built a go-kart track just a mile away from my house where I lived, my dad's house, and so it was on the west side of Albuquerque there, and so it was almost like it was meant to be, you know, and so once that go-kart track appeared, then I was just begging Dad to get me a go-kart, and he did, And then just the rest is history, you know.
Yeah, I know one thing that I read in your book, and by the way, I appreciate your book, A Checkered Past.
Thank you.
One of the things I read about was you have to develop, of course, a fearlessness to get into this racing. And one of the things that your family was involved in was the Pikes Peak Hill Climb. That's very unique and would seem to me to be pretty scary.
Well, yeah, if bad things can happen up at Pikes Peak pretty quickly, but as long as you're using your head and you don't have any mechanical failures, then it's a challenging road course, basically, is what it is. And so, you know, I had been going up there. My earliest memories of racing is at Pikes Peak when I was 5, 6 years old, so on. So, yeah, it was one of the deals that the family was discovered at Pikes Peak, as far as from the Indy owners, the car owners who ran the Indy 500. It was United States Auto Club Points Race Championship. Pikes Peak was one of those races that gave points to the United States Auto Club, and so that's what brought the Indy owners to Pikes Peak. And so the Unser brothers, was discovered up there by the Indy car owners, and so that was the path.
That was the progression.
To Indy. Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about your dad. I know this has been a tough time because just recently, I believe your dad passed away. Mm-hmm. Did he encourage you to follow in his footsteps, or was just that kind of natural for you?
No, absolutely, he encouraged me, and what. What's special about Dad is that he didn't push me into it where I didn't have any choices. The way he actually did it was that I wanted to do it. So, rules about it. I had to bring home good grades from school in order to race and that sort of thing. And so if I misbehaved, it was one of the first things that I was grounded from was the go-kart and the racing. And so, of course, he encouraged me, but he didn't push me into it. So
I know that you, as your racing career blossomed, you were influenced by some pretty incredible people. One was Mario Andretti. Tell me a little bit about your thoughts about Mario Andretti and how he affected your life.
Yeah, well, with Mario, my dad and Mario were teammates there in the early 70s, not 70 and 71, but 72, 73 is when Mario and Dad became teammates with Vel and Parnelli Jones, and it was the first super team, they called it. They were the first team to bring the cars in, the trailers that they used were 18-wheelers. So it was the first time that big rigs come into the track. And so it was your first three-car team with Joe Leonard, Mario, and my dad. And so it was nicknamed the Super Team. And so it was right at that age, you know, 9, 10, 11 years old, that very influential. You know, Mario was just somebody that we went and snowmobiled with, and Michael, of course, was there snowmobiling and stuff. But we lived on opposite ends of the country. They lived in Pennsylvania. We lived in New Mexico. But during the winter and then during the summer at the races, we would hang out, Michael and I, and there at the track and get in trouble, stuff like that. So. But it was all fun. I just looked up to Mario because he was a friend of my dad's. AJ Foyt was a friend of my dad's, and I was able to be friends with them, and so I looked up to them, and it just happened. You know, Mario was still at the peak of his career when I started racing in 1983 in the Indy cars, and so he was one of the toughest competitors out there. So I knew I needed to learn from him, from Rick Mears, AJ Foyt, you know, all those guys.
You had to race against your dad many times. What was it like racing against your dad emotionally?
It was fun, you know. The thing about my dad was offering me advice all the time up through the go-karts, the sprint cars. You know, before I got to IndyCars, Dad would come up and say what I was doing wrong or what I was doing right and that sort of thing. And then once I started racing against him, the free advice went away. Okay, I had to ask the question, and as long as I asked the question, he was truthful with me, you know. And so, but I had to ask the question because we were competing.
I know that you came close to winning a number of times before you finally pulled it off. 1992, closest win on record. You beat Scott Goodyear by 0.043 seconds. Tell me about that race.
Well, first off, it was cold. It's the coldest day in the history as far as temperatures are concerned with. There was a lot of accidents that day because of the cold temperatures with the cold tires and so on. Michael Andretti had everybody covered. He was so fast. There was nobody touching him. There was at one point he had a full lap on the entire field. Scott Goodyear and I, about the last 50 laps, we were in a race back and forth for second place, and we were so equal that we couldn't pass each other on our own. The only way we could pass is if we came up on lap traffic and we were able to get by the other guy. There near the end of the race, Scott Goodyear was in front of me. We came on some lap traffic that wrecked his momentum. I was able to get by him. And within a lap of that, Michael's car broke. Hmm. And so he started slowing, you know. And I just happened to be in front of Scott at that time. And so when it went green again, you know, there was no lap traffic or anything like that. And so, which made it the closest finish. I was super lucky that we got it done.
You got it done. You've been very open in your book, A Checkered Past, about your life, about the partying and about the drugs and the alcohol during those days. At what point in your life did you begin to realize that it was a problem for you?
Gosh, it's hard to pinpoint a time. I honestly felt, you know, with the successes that Shelley and I, my first wife, that we were having with the family, and then with the racing, you know, it was probably the early 90s, you know, is when I first, you know, started going, you know, there's something wrong with this picture on what's going on. But we were still winning races and that sort of thing. And then we won the 500 in 92. And I think at that time I had put so much into winning the Indy 500 that once I did it, I had nowhere to go. It was one of those things that, be careful what you wish for, because you can get it. Okay. I think it's a progression. You never know, as far as an addict or an alcoholic, you never know when you step off that cliff. You can't really pinpoint it. It's a disease that has a progression to it, and you don't really know until you're in the throes of it. So
in 1994, you won again. Was it the same type of euphoria? Was it a little different for you?
It was a little different, to be honest with you. You know, my rookie year was 1983, and I would qualify for the Indy 500 every year, 84, 85, 86. At the end of qualifying, I would go down the backstretch, and I'd become very emotional, and I'd have tears. And that happened every single year. And then when I won it, that was one of the biggest things I noticed when I came back in 93 and I qualified, I wasn't overwhelmed with emotions of going down the backstretch after qualifying. you know, when we were successful in 94, it was for Roger Penske and Marlboro and the Penske organization, and it had a new engine that no one else had, and so the development of that engine was the big part of us winning that race. And so there was so much more into the details of that race that it was less emotional, you know, because really I think the first one is the one that's very emotional. And then, you know, when you start winning it after that, it's always a great day at Indy when you win, no matter if it's the first or the second, or like my dad, the third or the fourth, or Uncle Bobby, his three wins. It's very, very special, and each one is very, very unique. But I would have to say myself, I was less emotional in 94 than I was in 92.
You run into a lot of people that are friends, I'm sure, in the racing community. You're together a lot. But I noticed that one of the people that you talked about in your book was Emerson Fittipaldi, who apparently was a good friend of yours. Tell me about him, and tell me what he means to you.
Yeah, well, Emerson is just a fantastic man, a great human being. He's the godfather to my second daughter, Shannon. And he is one that truly cares about the drivers, the competitors, you know. He was the one that pulled Niki Lauda out of the burning Formula One car in the 70s. And Emerson became a good friend. I mean, he was a friend before we got together in 1989. Probably is one of the most reasons why I gave thumbs up and congratulated him after the 89 race, after we had gotten together, because he is a great human being, and I call him a very, very close friend.
Another person that is throughout your book and has stayed with you in the good times and the bad is Roger Penske. And
that's,
I know,
right.
You have an extremely strong relationship with him. Mm-hmm. Tell me, if you can, what Roger Penske means to you.
Well, I mean,
that's probably a question that could have its own show, right?
It could have its own show. You know, he, as far as growing up with Roger, he sets standard in IndyCar racing and has for a very long time. I watched my Uncle Bobby drive for him and be super successful. I watched my dad do it. I watched Rick Mears do it. A lot of drivers have gone to Roger and have been super successful. And the thing about Roger, what I think is helps him the most in his company, in his corporation, is he understands that good people are the success around everything, and he gives those people, all of his employees, all of his people, the opportunity for them to be the best that they can be. So he takes out the obstacles of money or hours or what have you, and leaves it up to that person to become who they really are. And he encourages that. And so with Roger, he understood more about what I was going through in the race car than anybody that I had on my radio, for example, strategy-wise and that sort of thing, and knew what I was going through. And then off the track, he knew, you know, what would be best for you and that sort of thing. And then he lets you be who you are. And so Roger tried to help me when I was ill and sick, but I wasn't ready for it. And so, you know, when you're not ready, you're not ready. And so it doesn't matter who's trying to help you, it's not going to get done.
In your book, you are very open about your life, very open about the things that you have gone through. In fact, it's been kind of raw. Your book details your victories, but it also, you talk about your downsides, the rehabs that failed, the relationships that went bad, everything that was in there. What motivated you to open yourself up so much and put your life on the line in words?
Honestly, I think it had to do a lot with my new relationship with Jesus. I think that was the turning point. You know, we got into COVID, okay, and locked down on COVID, and I was searching at the time to try to find some income, a job, that sort of thing. And so I went and tried to become an author, okay? Because no one, you know, this idea in my head that, you know, I've never come out with a book, maybe it's time I come out with a book. And so I prayed a lot about it, and I went, you know, okay. So, you know, I was going to put my true life in there, just tell the truth and let the chips fall where they may. It was funny because my mom was advising me not to do that. She goes, you know, you don't want to do that sort of thing. And I go, well, it's the truth, you know? So I started it. I started to become an author. I did an online class and that sort of thing. And once I got into it, I found out how difficult it is to be an author. Okay. And I went, oh, okay. So I'm over my head on this one. And then I got to a point where I'd like had writer's block or what have you. And so I called Jade Gerse, who did Andretti's book, Dale Jr.'s book. I had worked with him before on another book called The Beast, which was the engine, that trick engine that we ran in 1994 mm-hmm. with Roger. He did such a great job there. And so I called him up and asked him if he would give me a hand. And he said, sure, I'd love to. And so we started doing it. And quite honestly, it was very therapeutical. It was something, you know, there was several days there that we got into some areas that I had to tell Jade, you know, I need a break here because I'm crying and I can't talk and stuff like that. And he said, no problem, you know, we'll attack it again in the next few days whenever you're ready. And so it was a true blessing to have Jade Gerse there. And with the book, it's Jade Gerse's magic, him being an author, that put my voice and my thoughts on paper for the reader. You know, I can talk and do an interview, but there's a whole nother talent to putting it on paper and having the reader read it and so on. And that's where, you know, God blessed us with Jade Gerse, and here we are.
Yeah, I thought it was a tremendous book, and I really felt like I was right by your side as you were talking.
That's all Jade Gerse, I promise.
Did a tremendous job, no doubt about that.
He did a super job, yeah.
You were one of the most loved drivers out there, no doubt about that. But there's so much pain in this book. And you talk about, as I said, the divorces, the financial ruin, the relationships. But there's one incident in the book in which it seems to be that you hit bottom when you describe holding the pistol in your hand. Mm-hmm. And I bring it up because you brought it up in the book.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that as to what that meant in your life?
Sure. That was, it was 2012. I had just come out of another rehab, my third one. And I was alone for the first time. I came out of that rehab and I was getting a divorce from my second wife. My girlfriend, who was in Albuquerque, she had broken up with me, and so I literally had nobody in my life, and it was the first time that I was alone, and just going to the grocery store, just doing my laundry, just getting up was overwhelming to me. You know, and how could I be in this position when I've been so successful in my life and that sort of thing, and now here I am, just utterly alone. And so, you know, I had the state of New Mexico trying to put me in jail because I was facing another DUI, and that was, you know, I was waiting for the court hearings and stuff, And so, yeah, I mean, it was, I kind of saw a point where there was no way out for me. And then, you know, it was, I was seeing a psychiatrist at the time, and I truly, I asked him for some antidepressants, because I couldn't breathe, I couldn't sleep, I couldn't eat. It was just, it was just hell. And so I asked him for some antidepressants, and he goes, Al, I've been seeing you now for about 6 months, and you know, my professional opinion about you is you're depressed. I get it. But you do not have depression. Mm-hmm. And so I'm afraid that if I give you an antidepressant, then all I will be doing is putting another drug in there, basically the same thing you've been doing for your whole life. When you get depressed, you go to alcohol or drugs or what have you, and if my professional opinion is you do not have depression. And so the answer's no. He told me no, and I go, well, I'm about to kill myself. He goes, I'll make you a deal. He goes, you do it in the morning. Don't do it at night. If you make that deal with me, promise you make that deal with me, that if you feel like ending your life when you get out of bed in the morning, then you do it. You just go ahead and do it. And I went, okay. And so, long story short, every morning I would wake up after that, I got this. I can go on. And then as the day goes on, I would get more and more and more depressed, thinking about where I'm at in my life and so on. Because remember, I don't have Jesus in my life at that time. Mm-hmm. I'm a believer in God, but I have no study of the Word, no study of, you know, John and Luke and so on. And so, you know, so by the end of the day, the gun would come back out again, but I made the deal with the psychiatrist, and so I'm not going to break that deal, so I'll wait in the morning. But so that day never came to where the gun was an option.
Amazing how God works. I know you mentioned a conversation that you had not too many years ago, actually, with Michael Andretti, where he asked you about your relationship with Christ. Tell me about that.
Yeah, actually, he asked me if I knew what spiritually fit was. Mm-hmm. And I thought that he was asking me if I believed in God. And so I instantly go, well, yes, I know what spiritually fit is. And then he goes, good, okay, great, you know, good. And so it stuck in my head, and the more I thought about it, I even came home. It was at an actual race event. I came home, and my mom is a devout Christian. She's born again, firm believer in Jesus Christ, all this, and she helped me become a believer also. And I asked her, I go, do you know what spiritually fit is? And she goes, no. And I go, well, we need to get spiritually fit. We need to be better spiritually fit. And so as I, you know, I thought more and more about it, I go, you know, if you want to be physically fit, you go to the gym, you work out on a daily basis, and you help your physical body with that, and improves your mind, all that kind of stuff. And so spiritually fit has to do with something of those lines. And I started thinking about it, and, you know, that's where the daily readings come in. That's where, you know, being a part of Jesus Christ's life, making him a part of your life is exercising in being spiritually fit. And so as I took it more and more, I ended up getting baptized and, you know, and just really going all in with Jesus, because it was something that I had not done before. I had tried everything else, you know, the rehabs, the AAs, the Eastern religion, you know, with karma and that sort of stuff, and the one that truly helped me the most out of everything was Jesus Christ and being baptized. Yeah.
When did your life, you talk about being baptized. Tell me how long ago that's been. And I know that you said that one of the things in the book is when you were baptized, when you came up out of the water,
it was an
incredible experience. Tell me about
that's
that.
That's right. Yep. It was 2020 when I got baptized. It was, I forget the month. It was June or July. It was during the summertime that I was baptized, and it was such an overwhelming feeling, you know, I hadn't realized it. Now, I had been baptized when I was way younger, Catholic baptism, where I got the thumb of water on my forehead and so on, at the same time that my son, my youngest, little Joe, was baptized. But that for some reason, that wasn't, I wasn't ready or what have you. It just wasn't the same. Where when I came up out of the water, I felt the Holy Spirit so strong within me, and I realized, you know, what that means to be on fire with Jesus, you know, and so it was great. It was something that I truly recommend to anybody to go, and even if they've been baptized as a baby, go and do it as a grown-up and make it a decision of your own to go and study the Word, because it has totally changed my life.
Al Unser Jr. has been our guest, and I want to thank you so much for the book, and thank you for the words you've had today. I want to ask you, do you think the racing community, would they know you today from what they have known you in the past? What's your relationship right now with the racing community?
It's the same as it always has been. You know, at the racetrack, I was respected. I gave respect. I respected them. They respected me. Everything on the dark side, it never appeared in the racing fraternity at the track. So today, my relationship is just as strong as it always has been. You know, and maybe even a little bit stronger now, because I've came so truthful in the book and it became so raw about my personal life. They have a better understanding of what was going on in my personal life. And so I'm just as human as anybody else out there. And that's one of the main reasons for being so truthful in the book is go, hey, I'm human and I make mistakes. And so, you know, but we can come through it and so on. And there's help out there. And so, as long as I felt, if I shared my true life and where I went and how I've come through it, all that, if I could help just one person from my lessons in life, to seek help and get help, because that was one of the hardest things for me, was to ask for help and so on. And so it's definitely out there. It's hard. It's difficult. It ends up really being your choice to do everything, which it is your choice to ask that first help. So
I know that, of course, Jesus Christ is number one in your life. You've said that one of the things you want to do for the rest of your life is to let people know about Jesus Christ.
Yes.
Do you have a verse? I'd like to close maybe this way, and I'm kind of catching you off guard a little bit maybe, but is there a verse now that particularly stands in your mind or means anything to you?
The one verse, it's John. I don't know the exact number, but he's talking about Jesus is saying, you know, only through me can you get to God and so on. And that if you believe in me, you will have eternal life. And that's what got me started down the path of Jesus Christ. And so I was taking my mom to church every Sunday and so on, and just being the good son, yeah, taking her to church. And I finally, one day, after about a year and a half of doing this consistently, you know, I started thinking, well, you know, looking around and seeing all these people and how happy they are and that sort of thing. I go, well, you know, I ought to give this a try, you know, and be a believer in Jesus. And the second I did that, it was instant. I had a warm feeling in my stomach that instant. And I went, this is cool. This is good. And so it went from there. And all I did was just, I believe in Jesus Christ and his life is eternal. And so can mine. And that was it.
Al, again, it's been fantastic. One final question, just to let people know where you're at now. You're not racing, or are you racing?
No, I retired from driving.
What are you doing now?
Yep. I've worked for a team, which, again, I met the car owner, Mark McAllister, through my pastor, John, introduced me to him from the church, and he thought that we would get on real good, and he's he has started this race team. I'm his director of competition. I started out as a driver coach, and now I'm his director of competition, which has something I never thought of in my whole life that I would be doing. But I'm now kind of managing this team, and what the cars are, they're SCCA Formula 4 and SCCA Formula Regional, which is like Formula 3 cars. They're the next step right out of go-karting. So our drivers are like 16 to 18 years old, and they're really driving their first real race car for the first time in their life. And so it's been a real blessing that I've been able to give back to the sport that gave me so much. So I wake up every morning pinching myself that this is true and that sort of thing, and it's just a true blessing that I get to come and help out.
Al, thanks again, and it's been such a pleasure to do the interview, and God bless you in your future endeavors.
Thank you so much.
All right. Al Unser Jr. of Indianapolis 500 and racing fame. We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll give you more for Face to Face. So don't go away. You're listening to Face to Face. Welcome back. We hope that you enjoyed our time with Al Unser, and I certainly had a good time with him. He is now, as you heard, he is now a part of teaching young men and women how to drive race cars with the SCCA Formula 3 and Formula 4. Another thing that Al has done is he and his wife Norma have formed a group called the Wings and Wheels Foundation.com. Wings and Wheels Foundation.com, which not only helps people, but it is a way in which, as it says on his card, future stars of racing are crafted. And they have as their key verse Isaiah 40:31, and Isaiah 40:31 says this: but those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength. They will soar on wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not be faint. That's the verse of the Wings and Wheels Foundation. I might also say that Al's life verse that he talked about there was John 14:6, where it says, Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life, and no one comes to the Father except by me. We hope that you've enjoyed this podcast with Al Unser Jr. Check back with us, and we'll have other podcasts of Christian athletes, so I hope you'll join us at that time. Thank you.